This podcast of Studio 360 is supported by Squarespace.com, helping to provide a way for anyone to create a professional-looking website or blog. For a free trial and special offer for Studio 360 listeners, visit Squarespace.com and use offer code STUDIO4.
Today in Studio 360, Wayne Coyne, the leader of the Flaming Lips. While they were becoming one of rock's coolest bands, Wayne worked at fast food restaurants in Oklahoma City.
I was robbed at gunpoint, laid on the floor with a gun to our heads.
Nobody was shot, but Wayne Coyne's life was transformed.
It occurred to me for the first time that I was actually alive.
Suddenly, everything has changed.
And the performance artist Marina Abramović, who spent 3 months sitting silently in the giant atrium of a museum.
You can have a perfect trained body, but if your mind is not focused, it doesn't work.
Plus, the indie soul singer Teresa Anderson. That's all ahead today in Studio 360, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. On today's show, extreme performance art. It's not easy. You try sitting halfway up a gallery wall, naked, on a bicycle seat.
Things started going a bit black, and my ears started, like, tunneling out, and I was like, oh, no, it's a feeling when you're about to pass out.
We'll hear more about the passion and sheer stamina that goes into the performances by artist Marina Abramović. But first up on today's show... The Flaming Lips seemed likely to be just another 90s one-hit wonder. An alternative rock band from Oklahoma, they toured for a decade before finally hitting it big in 1993 with their song, She Don't Use Jelly.
She don't use jelly or any of these.
It was an ironic grunge anthem, and it got them a cameo on Beverly Hills 90210.
Hey, is that the Flaming Lips?
Well, it's not Michael Bolton.
That's for sure.
You guys seen Donna?
No, she's recovering from her wounds.
But the Flaming Lips didn't go all Hollywood or fade away. Instead, they put aside their guitars and started experimenting with tape loops and synthesizers, including, memorably, on their 9th album called The Soft Bulletin. Wayne Coyne is the founding mastermind of the Flaming Lips, and he says the Soft Bulletin came about as a result of the group's virtuoso guitarist leaving the band.
It was. Well, when he left, me and Steven, the other writer in the group with me, we almost decided, let's just not worry about guitars for a while, and we went in this other way. But we also thought it would isolate this small audience that we had and make them think, well, you guys, you know, now you suck. And so maybe we
the
realized
indie curse.
This. Well, right, that this, you know, if you're going to turn your back on us, yeah, you go ahead and make your boring, you know, symphonic music or yeah, whatever. But I would also say part of us was working in the idea that this could be our last record that we make.
Well, it's always good, isn't it, in any creative endeavor to make each one as though it could be the last, yeah?
I don't think people realize the power of that because, you know, you really are doing it and you can say, you know, I don't care what people think because we're doing this as our own statement. But if you're like us, that lasts for about 5 seconds and then yeah, you go, oh, my God, what's going to happen to us?
Well, and then you made another record. Then I think your next record, which was Yoshimi Battles the Pink Robots, came out and people liked it. Critics liked it. It sold pretty well. And I want to play
okay,
a little bit
yeah,
of that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That you have the most
That's Do You Realize? And I'm told that that album, Yoshimi Battles the Pink Robots, is in development to become a Broadway musical to increase your Renaissance man accomplishments even more.
Now that you say it, I got, you're right. But yeah, and again, you know, you playing that particular track, and these are hokey things to say. We've been given this great little gift that people love. I mean, people just love this song. But we did not consider it as being anything other than just another song. And it's this epic, beautiful statement. And every night we play it, it's the last song we play at the end of the night. And people cry, and people are just overwhelmed sometimes with a happiness and a satisfaction and a joy.
And that song that came out of what? What was the inspiration for writing such a thing?
You know, I have to say, for me, sometimes I'm literally sitting there in front of a microphone with my still use a four-track cassette recorder from the early 90s, and I'll just. You just simply strum a couple of chords and you'll sing something and you go, oh, that was kind of cool. And I remember singing the line. There's a line that says, do you realize happiness makes you cry? And do you realize that everyone you know someday will die? And it seemed to me something that I observed as you get older or that you have these experiences.
Let it.
And when I played that part of the demo for Steven, like I said, the other co-writer in the group, he was like, oh, that's just a perfect Wayne-ism. No one else but you would sing that in a song and make it seem so right and so genuine and so innocent. And I was like, oh, okay. And it becomes this signature line that is sort of sums up this existential joy that the Flaming Lips, I think now, to some people represent. I think there's a mystery as to how do you know the things you know? And I say, I don't really know, but I'll sing you a song.
Well, and that song, Do You Realize, is in fact the official state rock song of Oklahoma. And you're not just a guy who grew up there and now lives in Brentwood. You're still an Oklahoman and have been.
Well, yeah. And again, you know, none of that ever occurred to us to be that big of a deal. This music came from Oklahoma. How bizarre, you know, as if it came from outer space or something.
Right.
And I think, you know, I've said it before, it's kind of like Santa Claus coming from the North Pole or the Beatles coming from Liverpool. When you can come from a place,
right,
and it evokes something, I mean, that's right, really how innocent we were. It never occurred to us that we should move to a Los Angeles or a New York or something.
Well, similarly, I've read that you worked as a cook at Long John Silver's for years after you started the band, right? I mean, you would go out and tour and then go back and fry fish sticks?
Well, I don't want you to paint this that as we are so successful as a band that I would sacrifice my time as an artist to go back there and cook. I mean, we didn't make very much money. We would tour around like a lot of groups did back then. You would just simply go out and play.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes you'd make money. Sometimes you wouldn't. And I was lucky that, I mean, I started working, I'm not sure everybody knows what a Long John Silver's is. It's a fried fish place,
yes,
you know. But it is wonderful, and I still eat it once a year. We sort of restrict ourselves. But, yeah, I started to work there when I was 16. And I have to say, I really loved it. But that's easy for me to say because now I'm in a successful.
You're not doing it now.
Yeah. But I some of those things that happened to you there, and I would say that I was robbed at gunpoint, laid on the floor with a gun to our heads because we were robbed late one night, thinking that here I was. I was going to be just a statistic that you read in the paper the next day, that I was, you know, that we were killed during a robbery at this fast food restaurant. And those things, the robbers, you know, eventually they left without killing us, obviously. But we laid on the floor for a little while in just this silence and going, you know, they're going to come back.
Right.
But we all sort of got up together. It was myself, and there were three other gals, and we all sort of looked at each other. And it occurred to me for the first time that I was actually alive. I'd never thought in my whole life that I'm alive. You know,
yeah.
I mean, I can't say how profound it was.
And then it freed you to become a rock star. your newest album, which is Embryonic, came out a couple years ago, seems like Flaming Lips 3.0, that you're going beyond the old symphonic sweep. And I hear a little more pessimism in some of the lyrics than we've been used to. Like, I want to play a little bit of See the Leaves about...
Excellent, yeah.
...where we're going environmentally.
See the leaves, we're dying again. See the love, it's fine again. See the grass, it's dying again. See the sun, it's trying again.
That is Flaming Lips' See the Leaves, which is exactly the kind of song that at 22 or 24 I would have played loud and again and again and again. And there you are making it you're almost as old as I am. Did you feel like you were swerving in terms of the sensibility you wanted to portray on that record?
Well, even though, you know, some of these previous songs, The Race for the Prize and the Do You Realize, even though we knew that we created those and those, you know, took a certain mindset or whatever, we never really left any of that other stuff behind. And especially in that song, See the Leaves, I think we're hinting at this thing that is nature. It is the greatest thing. It's the only thing, but it's also the most powerful and horrible thing that we have. I saw a nature type film on some cable channel, and a group of hungry lions attacked a water buffalo, and they were actually eating his back legs, and this water buffalo was still alive. And this idea that somehow, oh, nature just takes care of you.
Yeah.
You know, it's not. And so I thought, that's not the only truth there. And sometimes I'd say, you know, the things we said back then, I was wrong. You know, now we say this. I mean, you're allowed to just say the truth as it occurs to you at that time. I think that's what art is. You
know? Well, and speaking of saying the truth as it occurs to you, you seem like such an incredibly pleasant, nice guy. and yet, over the last couple of years, I've seen you make all kinds of trouble for yourself by slagging bands you've played with, like Arcade Fire and Beck. And is that just because you're a guy who doesn't edit yourself and just tells the truth?
Well, again, I'd say it's the truth as it happened to me, but, I mean, the Arcade Fire has a billion great things said about them every day.
Right.
Everybody thinks they're the greatest thing in the world, and I actually like some of their music quite a bit. And I bet I'm the only person that said anything other than they're the greatest thing ever. I don't really remember what I said. I'm sure it was something like, I think they're a bunch of or whatever. You know, I don't really know.
Pretty much.
Yeah, you know. And in my experience, they were. I mean, I won't explain the whole story because it's long, but we were at a festival, and the Arcade Fire walked in. Everybody had to clear out of their dressing rooms. They locked off the stage. Everything was treated as if the Arcade Fire are now Guns N' Roses, and you're not allowed in here because they're rock stars, and you're just insignificant.
How un-Canadian of them, too.
Well, I thought so, and I really didn't really even care about it anymore. To me, it had become sort of exaggerated and funny, and so I would say maybe they've changed, and none of that is true now that was perhaps true then, and I would just leave it at that. And if I saw them again today, I could say, let's try again and see where we are now.
Yeah. So who else do you think is a jerk? We can start a new feud today.
I think we lose too much by being too cautious. The risk of saying something that we can't take back, so what? Who cares? I mean, this is music. It's art.
It's rock and roll.
We're supposed to have opinions. We're supposed to be weirdos. Yeah.
Wayne Coyne, it's been a complete pleasure, and I'm going to thank you very much.
Yeah, and like I said, I love your show, so thank you for having me on.
We'll be right back.
Wayne Coyne's the leader of the Flaming Lips. They're on tour this summer in the U.S. and Europe. Later this year in San Diego, a musical opens based on their album, Yoshimi Battles the Pink Robots. If you want to hear more of my conversation with Wayne, go to studio360.org. Coming up, for one of her performance art pieces, Marina Abramović sat still for hundreds of hours.
It's very easy to sit on that chair with your body and your mind can be Honolulu, but it's very different if you sit with your body and mind in the present.
The artist is present. That's next in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International, and WNYC. Stay with us.
This podcast of Studio 360 is supported by Squarespace.com, providing a way for anyone to create a quality website or blog. With hundreds of design templates and apps for updating on the go, Squarespace provides many features to create or update a website or blog, including widgets to display Flickr photos and messages from Facebook and Twitter. A free trial and special offer for Studio 360 listeners is available at squarespace.com, offer code STUDIO4.
I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360. This summer, HBO will show a documentary called The Artist is Present, both in theaters and on TV. It's about the performance artist Marina Abramović. The filmmakers followed her as she prepared for her big retrospective at New York's Museum of Modern Art in 2010. And that's also when we sent Carrie Hillman to talk with her.
I've been waiting to sit with Marina Abramović for over an hour now. And judging by the line of people ahead of me, I'm going to be here for a very long time.
So far it's quite interesting. The steadiness of her is quite like a sculpture in a way, a life sculpture. I've seen a couple of almost tears coming out, but they haven't come out yet.
The performance is part of the retrospective Marina Abramović, The Artist is Present, and it's magnificent in its simplicity. Two oak chairs and a small table placed in the center of MoMA's frenzied atrium. The artist, taking a cue from the title of the show, will be present all day, every day, during the entire three-month exhibition. We can sit with Marina as long as we'd like. She'll remain silent, even after hours, until May 31st. Marina told me about it a few weeks ago.
So we walk into my chair, which I have here in my loft, because I'm exercising sitting on this. And also peeing to see that everything is fine. And I'm now waiting for my dress coming next week to see how it's going to all work.
A special dress that allows her to relieve herself while performing. Now that's commitment.
Why you don't sit to see how comfortable it is?
Okay, I'm going to have a seat here. Oh, no, this is... This the subway benches are far more comfortable. Wow.
You know, if it's comfortable, your mind can just go away. You can fall asleep. It's not right. You have to be very aware, you know?
Marina specializes in long performance pieces. She once lived for 12 days on a narrow ledge. But this piece, The Artist is Present, is her longest ever. She's been preparing with a trainer and a nutritionist to build her stamina.
I found the long-durational work is the most transformative on the performer, but also on the audience seeing it. It's kind of luminous energy who comes out of this, which can be done only if you really have this kind of discipline to concentrate. Because it's very easy to sit on that chair with your body and your mind can be Honolulu, you know, but it's very different if you sit with your body and mind in the present, which is the main core of this piece.
The Museum of Modern Art has never had a major retrospective for a performance artist, and it raises some pretty tricky questions, not the least of which is, how can a museum acquire and exhibit a work of art when the canvas is flesh and blood? All of Marina's pieces involve Marina, often doing grueling and even dangerous things. She's 64 now, incredibly vibrant, but still, what'll happen to her work when she can no longer perform it? Klaus Biesenbach is chief curator at large for MoMA and organized the exhibition.
I think Marina, for the last years, has established a legacy to claim that performance art is treated like a theater piece, like a score, and therefore she proves that you can reperform it as a theater piece can be reperformed, as a concert can be reperformed.
And I understand that performance is a living art form. If it's not reperformed, it's kind of going to die and finish in the, you know, dusty books and doesn't have life.
So while Lorena is busy being present downstairs, 36 young artists and dancers, handpicked by her, are continually reperforming five of her pieces in 2.5-hour shifts. One is Luminosity, where a nude performer is perched on a bicycle seat midway up the gallery wall and lit from behind.
My name is Yo Smith, and I'm performing Relation in Time, Nude with Skeleton, and also Luminosity. For Luminosity, it's just like my personal thing, but like I'm gonna have my penis tucked under the bicycle seat, so I want to look like I have a female part on the bottom and then male part on top. So some people might be very uncomfortable looking at it. You know, like people will say stuff, you know, like maybe throw something at me. Who knows?
And what about some of Marina's early work, like Rhythm Zero, where she arranged objects on a table, including a loaded gun, and invited visitors to use them on her? One guy put the gun to her head. Or Lips of Thomas, where she carved a 5-pointed star into her stomach with a razor blade. You can't pay people to do that. Literally.
And it's not only that, but also the city of New York have the fire law, so that the space between in Poderabilia, when they're standing in the door entrance, they have to be bigger just because of that kind of restrictions.
Imponderability required a visitor to squeeze awkwardly between Marina and her partner, who were both naked, to get into the exhibition. In the re-performance at MoMA, I was able to pass through with only a shift of my shoulders. Easy.
So I will put a label next to this piece. That piece, because of that law, was altered.
Still, to my mind, the biggest challenge isn't fire code or labor law. It's whether the re-performers can deliver a moving or even transformative experience for the viewer.
With Marina, she doesn't like to rehearse. So instead of like being in the studio, we went on 3-day retreat / workshop, kind of like a boot camp.
So it's basically go to the countryside. We all sleep in the barn, just on the floor next to each other in sleeping bags. We wake up very early, 5 in the morning. We go to the river, wash without soap in really ice-cold river, which is very good. Do exercises, not eat or talk for 3 days. Absolutely no any kind of food. Just drink hot water and do heavy exercises, mental, physical.
She gave us like a whole bunch of grains, different kind of grain, like barley, like rice. Mix them up, and then we'll start counting them and separating them for like about 3 hours.
Marina's very into Tibetan Buddhism, and she lived with Australian Aborigines for a year.
Because, you know, you can have a perfect trained body, but if your mind is not focused, it doesn't work.
Brittany Bailey, a 20-year-old dancer, is finishing up her shift on the bicycle seat for Luminosity.
That was like something I've never done before.
It's a carefully choreographed exit, complete with a lab coat and an escort. And although Brittany had a shaky start,
things started going a bit black and my ears started like tunneling out and I was like, oh no, it's a feeling when you're about to pass out.
After a few deep breaths, the moment passed, and she got it.
I felt something that feels universal before, and I can sense, like, the infinity, like, how, like, whatever I'm feeling or seeing could go on forever, and that it just creates that really peaceful place inside of you. But then it was interesting feeling that sense of infinity and peace and everything, but actually seeing it in a box, which is what was happening in the space.
The hush in the room around Brittany felt reverential. And in a funny twist, as we watched her bare torso rise and fall, we were the ones who felt naked and exposed.
I really believe that if you really purify yourself, you can create some kind of source of oxygen to the audience. This is the main function of an artist.
Brittany's task, and Yosmeet's, is to live Marina's piece like it was theirs. Because it's only through their experience that we find meaning in this work. They act like a sort of mirror. By opening themselves up, we see how we've become closed off. By being fully in the moment, they force us to look at how we live in the past, or strive for the future. What really matters is now, the simple exchange between two people. It's powerful stuff. Anything less and we can sense it. Then Marina's work, the nakedness, the ballsy physicality, become like extreme performance art, just entertainment.
I always think that everything else will be waste if you don't really put yourself in the situation that you really deliver something, you know. In your life, you can't take anything material when you die. The only what you can leave is a good idea.
For Studio 360, I'm Carrie Hillman.
The new documentary about Marina Abramović is called The Artist is Present. It premieres on HBO this summer. The product designer Karim Rashid is not a fan of right angles. Almost everything he designs is curved, such as the Umbra O chair and the Garbo trash can. His stuff is made of colorful plastics, a little groovy, and on sale pretty much everywhere. Karim Rashid was born in Egypt, grew up in Canada, and found his calling as a designer early on.
Well, you know, when I was a child, I was very quiet, believe it or not, and quite introverted. A lot of people find that hard to believe, I guess. And I would hide under the bed, basically, and draw for 6 hours straight. And I loved to draw. And I, you know what I would draw, basically, is little utopias of worlds that I wanted to live in. My little utopia. And I'd actually draw little, you know, buildings and little architectural structures and little, I don't know, little like vehicles that would contain your entire house in them, you know, almost like RV vehicles and things. And then I started loving to draw physical things. And I remember drawing all my mom's shoes and eyeglasses in the house, the stereo in the house. When I was about 5 or 6, we took a ship from London to Montreal, the Elizabeth, Queen Elizabeth. And, you know, that journey was, I don't know, 10 days or something. And there was a drawing competition on the ship. And they were, you know, because there was a lot of people on the ship, there were about 300 children. So we all had to draw something. And, you know, most children drew things like their family or the boats or the sun and landscapes. And I drew luggage. And I drew luggage because I was fascinated with this idea that we took our entire home and put it in a few crates and we were moving to the new land, you know, to Canada. I mean, you know, it was a really primitive drawing of kind of weird things trying to stuff. You know, the shoes go here and the clothes go here and all that. But that kind of was probably the first time I actually tried to really design something, you know. And I won the competition, by the way, which that's the only degree I have up on my wall, really, is a little plaque from when I was 5. If I can make something function beautifully and really well, I can almost get away with any sort of expression. So I make sure now that if I'm doing things that are kind of, you know, a bit radical or a bit kind of, let's say, what I would call inspiring, because I think things around us need to be inspiring and give us a feeling that we're more alive, etc. They got to work really, really well. And if they work, you kind of, in a way, met all the criteria, let's say, of what design is really about. A lot of times I find those simple ideas, in a way, the most powerful ideas. And they're really about, as designers, about being obviously very observant of behaviors, the way we do things. And you can see solutions very easily. I did a credit card for Visa, and it was, and I put 2 stripes on the card. So you could use the card either way. So you don't, you know. And then I even realized that, but it was too expensive for them to produce, was to put 4 stripes, 2 and 2. So it doesn't matter how you use a card, it will always work. You know, these are very, really simple. And the process of design is interesting. If you do these things in a very, like, they seem obvious, but if you do them, they allow you actually to shape new form or new aesthetics or new ideas. I am so interested in the new, in the world we live in now. You know, not only is it my field, it's in my DNA. It's the way I live. You know, if I could have a microchip in my hand, which, by the way, FDA approved 2 years ago, that I can wave to open up all my doors, even my car door, I love that because I hate keys. If I could get rid of the passport and just use my iris, I would be more than happy with my fingerprint. I don't want to carry around something that I'm afraid perpetually I'm going to lose, because that adds stress to my life. I'm always interested when the archetype is finally broken or terminated in a way. And we live with archetypes, and we keep revisiting them over and over and over again. And, even something like the laptop, the notebook computer, we've been hanging on to that archetype for 20 years. It's more or less still the screen opens up with the keyboard in front of you. So it's amazing that this stuff just stays and stays and stays until somebody, just one person, one company, just breaks the archetype and moves us to the next level. And that's the part I'm kind of fascinated with design. So if I had to think of objects that I love, they'd be, I guess, things that would break the archetype and really make us live in the moment in which we exist. I just did luggage this year for a company, and it's just actually going to production very soon. Most luggage right now is just a big empty volume, and you just mix everything in there. So again, I went back to this idea of compartmentalizing things, which is what I did as a child. When I travel, for example, now, I wear like shoes that have no shoelaces. I never wear a belt when I go through the X-ray. I'm all prepared. So I thought about luggage that way, in the same way. What could just make this whole experience a little bit easier? Make an object remove stress from our lives, because a lot of objects add stress and we put up with it.
Karam Rashid has literally thousands of objects in production. You can check out some of them at studio360.org. Our story was produced by Studio 360's Michelle Siegel and Josh Rogerson. Was there some family trip or other singular experience that finally launched you on your creative path? If so, we'd like to hear about it. Drop us a line at studio360.org. Coming up, the indie soul music of Teresa Anderson. She grew up in Sweden, but she's been living in New Orleans for years.
Lamplight flicker song, warmth of color washes me. The crowd is screaming for some more.
Teresa Anderson is just ahead. You're listening to Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
These eyes shooting stars in the dark sky. I'm not
This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. This week on our blog at studio360.org, we've got a really interesting story about the amazing creativity that bubbled up in just a few scruffy urban blocks over the course of the last century. It's an audio visit to my former New York neighborhood, the East Village, where a pantheon of poets live.
See that copper green statue on your right? Pause here for a moment.
The podcast is intended as a walking tour, but it works virtually, too, wherever you're listening.
One of the most ardent opera fans in the city was a young journalist by the name of Walt Whitman.
It's narrated by the film director Jim Jarmusch, the very embodiment of East Villageness.
You can hear that operatic long line in his poem, To a Stranger. Passing stranger, you do not know how longingly I look upon you.
You must be he I was seeking, or see I was seeking. It comes to me as of a dream.
I have somewhere surely lived a life of joy with you. All is recalled as we flit by each other, fluid, affectionate, chaste, matured.
You grew up with me, were a boy with me, or a girl with me. I ate with you and slept with you. Your body has become not yours only, nor left my body mine only.
You give me the pleasures of your eyes, face, flesh, as we pass. You take of my beard, breast, hands in return.
I am not to speak to you. I am to think of you when I sit alone or wake at night alone.
I am to wait. I do not doubt I am to meet you again.
I am to see to it that I do not lose you. Some people call Walt Whitman the grandfather of American poetry. His most direct literary descendant was probably Allen Ginsberg, who adopted Whitman's long free verse line and shared his love for New York City. Ginsberg lived in a number of buildings in the East Village, but the apartment he lived in the longest is across the street. It's 437 East 12th Street.
The East Village really was Allen's permanent home.
That's poet Bob Rosenthal, Ginsberg's friend and his secretary for the last 20 years of his life.
If you look up at the apartment building there, Ginsberg lived on the fourth floor.
The first time you come to visit Allen, you would have to yell up from the street, and he would open the big wide center window and throw down the key, always embedded inside a unmatched used sock.
Scores of poets fetched the key out of that sock. They would come knocking on this door, and Ginsberg, the master of ceremonies, held forth.
America, I've given you all, and now I'm nothing. America, $2.27, January 17th, 1956.
The East Village gave him freedom to be who he wanted to be gay, to be political, to be on drugs, to be whatever. It was cheap, and Allen was a very frugal person. He did not need the trappings of a nice apartment. He really lived in dumps. There was very little privacy, but Allen wasn't looking for privacy. Maybe the East Village was the only mirror that Allen ever needed.
That's just a little taste of Passing Stranger. You can hear the whole story at studio360.org. I'm Kurt Anderson. Teresa Anderson, no relation, has been playing music for most of her life, but her breakthrough came a few years back on YouTube. In her video, Anderson stands alone in the middle of her New Orleans kitchen, surrounded by this array of electronics, pedals, instruments, guitar, violin, dulcimer, drums, and then starts playing, all of them. And it's not just a wacky web video stunt. She's created this charming, infectious pop song. Teresa Anderson's brand new album, Street Parade, comes out next week. A few years ago, she brought all her instruments for a live performance.
Hello.
So, will you play something for us to start?
Sure, I would love to. Why don't I start with Na Na Na? Na na na.
That's Teresa Anderson in our studio performing Na 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 off her new album Hummingbird Go with Teresa Anderson on fiddle, Teresa Anderson on tambourine, Teresa Anderson on guitar, Teresa Anderson on xylophone, vocal, and backup vocal. That was great.
Thank you.
So I, as I say, have the pleasure of seeing you hopping around with incredible dexterity, taking guitar straps off your head and pushing buttons and doing the drums and all this stuff. How does that actually work? That so you decide, okay, now in at this moment in this song, I have to record the drum. Before you go play the drums, you push a lever with your toe? How does that work?
Well, it's kind of like having a flight manual, I think. And I check off everything in my head like a little list because there's so many buttons to push. If I forget one, I can be just stalled and not know what's going on. So if I were in a helicopter at that moment, I would crash and I wouldn't want that to happen. So as I'm playing the song, I do all this stuff simultaneously. Sometimes I even have to start and stop both pedals at the same time. And that's when the balancing act gets a little out of hand.
The audience must respond to just the sort of wacky, virtuoso pleasure of seeing you do all that stuff.
Well, actually, the audience ends up being a part of it because just the other night I was playing and somebody yelled out something. Luckily, it was a good thing in the beginning of one of my loops, and it came back every time.
Really?
Yeah, so anything the audience does becomes a part of the show.
And since you've recorded these bits in real time as you're going, does that... Do you keep that, or does that, at the end of a performance, just get erased?
It gets erased.
And you start fresh?
Yes.
Wow. I'd be tempted to keep them all. What if you had a really good riff one night and you wanted to keep it and use it again?
Yeah, but there's no sport in that.
It's true. So you were born and raised, as one hears just the slightest bit, in Sweden.
Yes.
On the island of Gotland.
The stämmer bra.
And you moved to New Orleans when you were 18.
Yes.
And 18 years later,
yeah,
you still live there?
I do, yeah.
How come you came to America and how come New Orleans in particular?
Well, I came to America and New Orleans for music and love and love of music. And then I've moved around a little bit, but I've always come back there. So it's really my American home.
Listening to this album, you've played with Alan Toussaint, you played with Dr. John, but there's nothing I can recognize as, oh, that sounds like New Orleans.
Right. It's probably a little bit disguised in my Swedishness. And I've used some pieces of New Orleans music in there. For instance, I sample a famous New Orleans drummer called Smokey Johnson. And, of course, from living in New Orleans, I've been very inspired by all the rhythms there, the retro R&B of the 60s and 50s.
Are there people, was there music you heard growing up that sort of galvanized you?
Yeah, well, I think my mother's records, there weren't that many, and they were all in this styrofoam cooler with like a red vinyl cover around it. And I just remember always digging through there and finding Ella Fitzgerald, Aretha Franklin, that kind of stuff. I actually used to think that Aretha was a screamer when I was little. I didn't like her then. But, of course, I got over myself and realized.
And you're an adult now.
Yes.
Can we hear another track off the record?
Absolutely.
What will it be?
I'm going to play you Birds Fly Away, which contains that sample from Smokey Johnson.
Great.
Yeah.
Shuffle our feet away, never more than hello. One more we let by, but like a photograph I took, one of many in a book I've lost. Took time to fade away, turn around, stay for the day in my town. Oh, birds fly away. Oh, oh, oh. Please stand strong, seek shelter. Do 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 do.
Seek shelter.
Teresa Anderson, thanks very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Teresa Anderson's brand new album, Street Parade, comes out momentarily. You can see our video of her performing at studio360.org. And while you're there, you can also subscribe to our free weekly podcast of Studio 360 so you can listen to the show wherever and whenever you want. And that's it for this edition. Thanks very much for listening. Studio 360 is a production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
Josh Rogerson,
Alana Harper,
Max Bernstein,
Rebecca Lee Douglas,
Thomas Seeley,
Krista Ripple.
Thanks also to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, for Michael Jackson impersonators, things are looking pretty good.
I said to Spider-Man, I made $560. And he said, no way, no one makes that kind of money on the boulevard. He said, not even Superman makes that kind of money.
Pretending to be Michael Jackson for a living. Next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.